I'm Greg Johnson.
And I'm John Morgan.
I'm Michael Polignano.
Welcome back to Countercurrents Radio. We're doing another one of our weekly shows, and with this weekly broadcast, we will be back on our regular Friday schedule. After the whirlwind of deplatforming and reorganizing, things seem to be getting back to normal. So thank you all for your help, our readers and listeners and donors, in making this possible. I want to begin with a few donations that have come in since the last podcast that we did. I want to thank Omar for $115. $30 from Jay, $40 from JR, $20 from Steve, $20 from JL, $50 from Jeff, $10 from Nate, and $50 from Paul. I also got a number of donations in the mail. I want to thank the people who sent those in. Some of them sent them in anonymously, so I can't thank you in person. And we got a number of Bitcoin donations recently, which are anonymous as well. I really appreciate those. One was especially generous, and everything is helpful. In the coming weeks, we're going to have a tutorial on digital cryptocurrencies and how you can get involved in these and how you can support Countercurrents in this manner. And Countercurrents is going to get up to speed with these currencies as well, so we can accept donations in all the different digital cryptocurrencies that are available. I want to make a special appeal to the people who were giving us monthly donations through PayPal. In case you haven't heard, those donations have stopped. Those donations were keeping us going, and we do have a bit of a war chest because of sympathy donations that were given to us over the last couple of weeks, basically the last 3 weeks now, because of the deplatforming from PayPal and with our loss of our web hosting platform. But we need to get those regular monthly donors back, and we have two ways of doing that now. You can make a monthly donation through Patreon is dead to us, right? Patreon.us. Go there and donate to Greg Johnson, be my patron. And basically, by being my patron, you're a patron to Countercurrents. That's the way it's set up. And the other option is available on our webpage, our website, and it's a monthly credit card donation. So one way or another, we really need to get you back for those regular monthly donations. I'm going to be sending personal notes to everybody who hasn't re-upped in the coming week, and I hope that this appeal and those letters will get as many people as possible back on board, because that really is what keeps us going. It's regular, monthly, dependable donations. Because of the ups and downs of our fundraising drives and the book market, that kind of steady support gives us a sort of floor and an ability to plan, an ability to make payroll, for instance, for Mike and John. So thank you very much for your past support, and please re-up as soon as you can, all you monthly donors out there who are listening. So what I'd like to do now is segue to the main topic that we want to discuss today, which is the collapse of the media narrative, the mainstream media narrative after Charlottesville. We've had 3 weeks now, more than 3 weeks, for that narrative to unwind, and it is steadily unwinding. And I think it's very, very encouraging, actually, that it is unwinding. Part of the reason it's unwinding is just because it's a lie, and people out there realize it now. But the reason why a lot of people are realizing it is because we have our own media and our own means of getting a counter-narrative out there, and it seems to be seeping in. It seems to be making progress. So let's talk about that. Mike, do you want to take the lead on this? We were talking about this before we started recording, and you seem to be the guy who's been most up to date on what's going on.
Well, I saw recently, I haven't been following everything day to day, but what brought me up to speed most recently was an article at Occidental Dissent, one of Hunter Wallace's articles. He wrote about Heather Heyer and her cause of death. An interview came to light, which Heather Heyer's mother did with NBC News. And in that interview, which she did about a week after the car ramming incident, she admits that Heather Heyer died from a heart attack and that her death was painless and quick. And with that statement, that challenges the narrative that she died directly from the blunt force trauma from the impact of the car. because the first person who treated her, some Antifa medic, wrote that she was treating a leg wound and also performing CPR. But the fact that her leg was wounded, but not her upper body, there's no mention made about any kind of other trauma aside from the leg, makes you question if she would have died or not if she hadn't been morbidly obese, which is something the mainstream media has ignored altogether, and which Andrew Anglin has talked about. He did make this point early on. Inappropriate, definitely, for him to poke fun at a woman who had just died. But, you know, Andrew's written about on several occasions, he does that to get the message out. But given what's happened since then with the deplatforming and being punished by Silicon Valley for starting this narrative, and then, of course, we were punished as well, as were many other people on the real right, that narrative that he started is all kind of coming into the truth of it is coming out the more facts that come to the surface, the more videos that are made public. But yeah, I got started on this just, you know, seeing Hunter Wallace's post of September 5th. The title of the article is actually called Heather Heyer Died of a Heart Attack.
Right. I mean, the fact that she died of a heart attack, does that really change anything legally or morally here? A lot of people would say, well, you know, the fact that she died of a heart attack rather than just being crushed by a car doesn't really change the fact that she was struck by a car. And if they want to argue that James Fields is responsible for that, if he did first-degree vehicular homicide or something, the fact that she died of a heart attack rather than some other means after being struck by a car, does that really matter at all?
Certainly not to the left. I also just want to say, though, I think by getting into this whole thing with Heyer, I mean, it's good to get the facts out there, but by, in a way, defending this guy, we're sort of making him our own. And I'm not sure that's really something we want to do. I mean, nobody really seems to have known who this guy was before that day, or even, you know, up to and including, you know, the moment of the accident. And we still, at least I haven't seen anything, any kind of statement about his supposed motives or anything. So as far as I'm concerned, this all still could have been some kind of an accident while he was trying to escape. So I don't know. I think it's good they're getting it out there, but I don't think we want to own this guy as one of our people.
No, I don't think so either. But I think he is innocent until proven guilty. And if nobody's defending, you know, the most generous version of what could have happened, which is not completely irrational, given the evidence that's emerged, I think that's the position we should take.
Right. Well, the fact that she was a fat woman, she was a smoker, and she was out on a hot day parading around in the streets with a violent mob, it might have been a little too much for her system. And it might have just been the fact that being bumped in the leg or struck in the leg by a car, we don't even know how serious her leg injury was, but that might have been just the straw that broke the camel's heart, so to speak. And in that sense, I don't know legally if it actually decreases culpability, but...
No, I don't think it does.
Yeah, but it certainly paints a different picture, I think, than the one that the left has been putting out there of this innocent who was mowed down by this maniacal driver of some muscle car. And I guess anything that psychologically changes people's feelings, even subconsciously, about this is probably a good thing. As far as narrative collapse goes, it's a small but significant change, I think.
Another thing that's come to light have been actual photographs of Heather Heyer as she was marching around before this incident. And the photos that they used to commemorate her after her death were at least 10 years old. So she really looks nothing like she does in those photos.
Yeah, that's sort of like whenever some black gangbanger is killed, they always find the one picture of him wearing a bow tie when he was in high school for a student picture or something, looking innocent. Or they'll even go back to grade school pictures. Anything to find a picture of them where they're not committing a crime or looking like they're about to commit a crime. So yeah, it's a standard technique. And, you know, the poor woman, I feel sorry for her. in some ways. They found a picture of her doing a selfie-type thing where she's trying to look her very best, but it was somewhat deceptive about the woman as she was at the time of her death.
Well, I also know, I mean, you know that whatever facts come to light, the left is going to continue to say, well, if she hadn't been hit by the car, she wouldn't have had the heart attack, which may very well be true. I mean, it seems like that was the trigger. So they're still going to try to pin it on us. Just like they seem to have finally dropped this, but for at least a week after Charlottesville, every news report I read mentioned the fact of those two cops dying. And I think that's now been shown that not only were they not, of course, killed as a result of anything that the Unite the Right people were doing, but they weren't even involved with Unite the Right at all. Apparently, they were providing security to the mayor or somebody at the time. The governor, yeah. So they weren't even actually involved with Unite. You know, they weren't even observing that. So it was completely unrelated.
Yeah, their only connection was they died in the same county while Unite the Right was going on.
Basically, yes.
Yeah. That level of dishonesty is so shocking to me. And I know I shouldn't be shocked by it. I should expect this, but I'm still shocked by it. And I'd love to sit down with a journalist and say, are you proud of this? And a lot of these hardened journalistic fake newsmongers are really proud of this kind of deception. You know, and they only feel ashamed if they get caught. And honestly, they don't even care that much if they get caught because they know that enough minds have been changed by their lies that will never be unchanged by the correction that, in effect, they get away with it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think they more enjoy knowing that they manipulated the narrative the way they wanted it than anything else.
Yeah, another shocking piece of footage that I became aware of recently was some footage that Faith Goldie took where she captures a group of blacks throwing rocks at three percenters who were at this rally and, you know, are not white nationalists. They were there to basically keep both sides safe and actually do the job that the police were supposed to do but weren't doing. And one of them, who was a war veteran, basically got hit by a rock in the head and had to have one of his comrades help him out, help walk him out. He was dazed. And that's captured in this video that Faith made when she was there. And that is shocking. And that absolutely challenges the notion that these communists were just there peacefully taking back the space, taking back the streets. They weren't. They were picking off small groups of nationalists who were leaving. And these guys, they're civic nationalists, I believe, but they're not racialists.
Right. That's interesting. There's been a lot of tweets and lots of statements by these people now indicating, of course, that they were there for violence. We don't have to speculate as to their motives because they're actually quite good at announcing their motives, and their motives were there to shut down Unite the Right, physically attack people. They brag about it. Of course, actually seeing them doing it is still helpful because pictures are worth millions of words, especially videos. But they openly admit what they were up to there. It's not really a mystery. It's not a mystery at all.
Yeah, well, again, it's the narrative breakdown because what they are saying and what the fake news media is saying are two totally separate things. Or at least they were. Then about a week after this whole took place, the Antifa attacked basically the civic nationalists meeting in Berkeley, California. And I think that was the straw that broke the back of the mainstream media as far as their willingness to call out Antifa.
Right. And that, I think, is very, very important. Once Berkeley happened, once our people basically bailed on the Berkeley thing, and it was just some Trumpian civic nationalists there being attacked by these leftist goons, it really woke a lot of normies up, I think. When I was hearing about this as it was happening, I was away from my computer, but I had my smartphone and a friend of mine was saying, have you seen this? Have you heard this? I said, no, I can't watch the video now. What effect is this going to have on the normie viewer? And he says, oh, it's going to be terrible for the Antifa because basically they're just a bunch of thugs beating up on old people carrying American flags and things like that. And I thought, okay, this is great for us. And then we had, of all people, Nancy Pelosi come out and attack, denounce Antifa. And we had a wave of liberal journalists, commentators, and so forth coming out and commenting on how these people are bad and how they're actually feeding the far-right narrative. Of course, the very idea that they could just be condemned as bad in and of themselves is a bridge too far for leftists, but they are willing to say that they're bad in the sense that they're feeding our narrative. And I thought that was very, very positive. And I've said this before, and I think it's worth pointing out, the claim that the left never punches left is false, and this is an obvious example of how more moderate people will disavow more radical people on the left if they disagree with them. And I do think they disagree with them fundamentally. But beyond that, they'll do it if they feel there's a political necessity to do so. And I believe that clearly the Democrats are looking at polling data and realizing that it's necessary for them to distance themselves from the far left, that the far left is a very bad look for them, that leftist identity politics are a very bad look for them, and that they need to start moving towards the center and appealing above all to white working class voters again. And if they don't do that, they're going to be slaughtered again. They were brutally bitten in the last election. They're still smarting from that, but the midterm elections in 2018 are shaping up to be another bloodbath for the Democratic Party, and I think they're retreating from that by trying to disavow both the extreme left and also identity politics, anti-white identity politics at this point. And we'll see more of that in the coming year, I believe.
Yeah.
One thing that I predicted right in the aftermath of this is that given that the city government was in cahoots with the police, not in cahoots, they gave the police orders to stand down and not separate the two clashing parties and to, in effect, engineer violence, that it wouldn't be just Unite the Right people who take legal action against the city. It'll also be the left. The left is going to sue for all the gibs they can get, and they would have as much right to as the people on Unite the Right, because the city wasn't protecting them either. And now this is happening, and there was a video that I saw that was just richly ironic. I forget where I saw it. It was one of these ultra-lefty tabloid-style websites, the gutter-left websites. There's so many of them. They showed a video of some guy who kind of looked like a Southern nationalist or a white nationalist guy. I don't know where he was on the spectrum. Take out his gun and fire it. Shoot at Unite the Right. And they said, look at this. The police weren't protecting us. People were going around discharging guns. The interesting thing was, is that before the frame focuses in on the guy who's shooting, you see that what he's pointing at, or in pointing in the general direction of, is this black guy with his improvised flamethrower who is attacking some of the Unite the Right people. And this guy pulled out a gun and shot, you know, I don't know what he shot or where he shot or if it was a warning shot.
I read he fired, just fired at the ground.
Yeah, it was a warning shot.
Yeah, a warning shot, yeah. But the fact of the matter is that it was so grossly, hilariously biased, because you can see that there's a guy who's clearly involved in the use of deadly force, right? A flamethrower attacking people, and this guy seems to be firing in his direction, and I took it to be a warning shot too. And yet this is being treated as evidence that these horrible racists were shooting at people, and shouldn't we sue the state and the city for not protecting us? So that is moving forward. I think the left is going to be spearheading legal action as well as people on Unite the Right. And it's a shame that the Unite the Right people have fallen out with one another. You know, Richard Spencer and Eli Mosley have denounced Jason Kessler. Kessler apparently wants to pursue legal action, but he can't really do it as effectively as he could have if he had the cooperation of some of these people like Spencer and Mosley. So while we're doing our Keystone Cops thing, the left is probably pulling together a coalition and getting together some lawyers, and they are going to be the ones who are going to be pursuing this. That's my prediction. I think there's already signs that this is underway. But that's interesting, and it's useful to us because whatever they can discover in their legal process can be used by Unite the Right people as well.
Yeah, definitely. To go back to the guy who pulled the firearm, the fact that he was only charged with discharging a firearm within a school zone is kind of a tacit admission by the prosecuting authorities that the use of lethal force was justified, or at least potentially, with this guy with a flamethrower. I think the warning shot might have been, you know, a step too far. I mean, I think pulling the gun out and basically aiming it at this guy probably would have done the trick.
Well, if he had seen it. Once you hear a gunfire, that does get your attention, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. It's very interesting. And is the guy with the flamethrower in jail yet? Has he been charged with anything? That's, I think, indicative of what's going on. We have this guy in video with his improvised flamethrower. Why is this guy not the number one target for arrest in this thing? Has he been charged with anything? Has he been arrested? Is there a warrant out for his arrest? Do we know his name yet?
I know there has been some discussion of him. Let me have a look here.
Yeah, he was actually a friend of the guy who was threatening the nationalists retreating the rally and got taken into this parking garage and got beaten up.
Oh, yes. DeAndre or DeMarcus,
right,
or De something or other. Yeah.
Right. There is another video that I actually posted to my Facebook wall. It shows that whole crowd when they're leaving. And there's definitely taunts and fighting words going back and forth. And any group like that can legitimately fear for their safety in that sort of environment. So, but that is another thing that the media just ignored entirely.
Well, I did find an article that was run just a day or two after Charlottesville about this guy. His name is Corey Long. The Independent in the UK did an entire article about him. First to him as a care worker who fought off white supremacist attackers with an improvised flamethrower.
Nothing shows you care like a flamethrower.
It says he had set out for a peaceful protest against, quote, Nazis who took over my town. Unquote. I mean, of course he knew it was going to be peaceful. That's why he made a flamethrower.
Yeah, exactly. He probably just had that thing there for his due or something, right? And he just was forced to improvise a flamethrower by these attacking Nazis. So, yeah, that's plausible.
Oh, I won't quote the whole article because anyone can just go and read this. But at the end, it says, Mr. Harris later said he suffered serious injuries to his head after white supremacists beat him with metal poles. But here he is doing this interview like the next day, so it couldn't have been that bad. I don't see anything about the flamethrower guy whose name I've already forgotten.
Corey Long.
Corey Long. Yeah, I don't see anything about him being arrested or charged or anything. I mean, they know who he is, so it wouldn't be hard for them to just bring him in. So apparently they're just going to let that go.
That's shocking. I'd like to confirm that because obviously the guy's caught on tape doing this act, which is criminal, unless they're saying it's not.
Well, if the guy who was firing the warning shot did something criminal, you would think that they would at least bring this guy in for a little bit of questioning just to make sure that everything is okay. Obviously, there's a huge double standard here, and that really brings us to the case of Christopher Cantwell. Have you guys been following Cantwell's travail since Unite the Right?
You know, I saw the Vice documentary and then the infamous video where he's in tears a couple of days later. I know he was arrested and he's in prison, but I haven't been really following it in detail since then.
Well, let's talk about the Vice documentary first of all. I was just cringing when he's in the hotel room showing off all of his weapons, wearing his camo.
Oh, God.
I thought, oh, my God, this is not a good look for us. And
no, he basically undid 30 years of progress on the right in the U.S.
Yeah, this was a throwback to the 80s, right?
It's 80s skinheads, yeah.
And I was just appalled by that. I just thought, this is not a good look. This is not a good thing to do. And on a certain level, though, I was also appalled by the cynicism of it, because I think the guy is cynical. He wants attention. And how is he going to get attention? He's going to get attention by giving El Reeve, who lives with and sleeps with a Jew and works for Vice and is making a career out of covering our movement, covering it in ordure, for that matter. She's making a career out of covering us, and he's getting her attention by giving her what she wants to feed her anti-white, anti-white nationalist, anti-right-wing narrative. That's not good.
No.
This is the equivalent of David Duke parading around dressed as a Nazi when he was in college or whatever. You can get attention that way, but it's not the right kind of attention. And one thing I want to come back to is, this can never be repeated enough. A lot of the stupidity in our movement today basically follows from the premise that all publicity is good publicity. In fact, if you hold that premise, you don't have to plan anything. You don't have to think about possible consequences of anything. You don't have to think three or four moves ahead like a chess player. You can just come up with some stunt and then have another drink, because you don't have to worry about possible consequences, because all the possible consequences, as far as you're concerned, are good. And that is so false, and it's so irresponsible, yet that is one of the guiding follies that gives rise to all kinds of mistakes. And the fact is that what Cantwell did is bad publicity for us. It makes us look bad. And yet, as far as he's concerned, it probably, you know, is good because it gets attention. But not all publicity is good publicity.
I have to admit, before Unite the Right, I'd never heard of him. So what exactly were his principles and what did he stand for prior to that?
Well, it's interesting. He was a men's rights guy, a MGTOW kind of guy. But as far as I knew, when he first popped up on the scene, he was an anarcho-capitalist. And he was friendly with the TRS guys, and one time he came on, and first of all, the guy is impossibly vulgar and profane and ranting in his style. And I guess that appeals to some people, but it sure doesn't appeal to me. But he was this vulgar, ranting, anarcho-capitalist when he first popped up on the scene for me. And I guess he's moved in the direction of being a full-out white nationalist now, obviously, but it's been a recent thing. It's been a recent within the last year.
Yeah.
In fact, within the last year, he was shacked up with a Puerto Rican woman and was using methamphetamine. Okay, that strikes me as a guy who's, how to put it? Well, he wasn't a principled racial nationalist even a year ago. And so he sort of popped up on our scene recently. Now,
not the sort of person you should have speaking for the movement.
Well, yeah, exactly. He's good at getting publicity because he's been getting publicity under various guises for a long time. But he's sort of a Johnny-come-lately to our cause. Now, let me make something very clear. I'm not saying that because he came recently to this that he's a fake or something. There's a lot of tinfoil hat stuff going around about Jason Kessler and so forth, that he's a fake because, you know, 2 years ago or 3 years ago or how many ever years ago he was an Obama supporter. There are lots of people who came to our movement who used to be Democrats. I met a guy recently who voted for Hillary Clinton in the last election, and now he's in our circles. So it happens. And the fact that our movement is growing rapidly means it's happening a lot more. And we should rejoice in this fact, not cast aspersions on people who show up recently. That being said, though, it's kind of foolish to push somebody like that forward as a spokesman, or let somebody like that push himself forward as a spokesman. And it just bespeaks a lack of organization and discipline and forethought, in my opinion.
Yeah, he's basically an entertainer. He's developed this following by being this shock jock who uses vulgar humor and has developed a following from that. And I think there's just sort of a lack of seriousness and, like you said, a lack of planning to allow somebody like that to just come in to an event like this and do that sort of interview and not really see that there's a big difference between this shock jock, TRS style, Daily Stormer style, that sort of thing, and being serious. And that's something that I think the movement as a whole is kind of coming to terms with. There was a lot of progress. We made a lot of progress, woke a lot of people up through poll and the Daily Stormer and the cynical humor, but when you're dealing with serious things, you have to be serious, and he wasn't. He was an entertainer.
Right.
Well, I think this is really something, it's becoming an overused term, but I think it's very much true of the alt-right, is that it's been in an echo chamber for the last year. And I think the people who were the leaders of this thing, it seems to me like they were starting to believe all this stuff, that it was really the alt-right that won the election for Trump, and it was a factor, but I don't believe that to be anywhere near the case. And I think that they thought they could keep using the same tactics that they were using during the election, especially these shock type things, to get attention. And I think they really did believe that, oh, we can go out and march with National Socialist Movement and the Klan and these things, and we're respectable now. I really find it hard to believe. I mean, Spencer is the person I've known the longest of all the major people who were at the event as leaders. And I really can't believe that even 2 years ago, he would have participated in an event like that. So I think it really shows the deterioration of discipline in the movement, that people think that they can basically get away with anything now. And Unite the Right shouldn't have been about uniting anyone who calls themselves right wing. It should be people who are on the same message somehow.
Yeah, I agree.
And I think this is where we see the strength of, you know, last week we were talking about the identitarians here in Europe and how before they allow a chapter from any country to become an official part of their movement, they vet them to make sure that they won't do anything that's going to end up embarrassing the movement as a whole. And I think Unite the Right demonstrates that we badly need, whether it's identitarianism or something else, something to kind of enforce this discipline on the right in the U.S. I don't know where that's going to come from, but it's clearly needed.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Well, I think you had these different groups in attendance there, each of which would enforce discipline within their own group. But as far as there being an overall confederation or, you know, any organization between groups, that just wasn't there.
Well, but they still agreed. I mean, I saw announcements weeks before the event about the National Socialist Movement, and I forget the exact name of this Klan group. So clearly, whatever they're trying to say now, I mean, Spencer and these other people knew that these people were going to be there. I think, you know, right there, that shows a lapse of judgment, personally. When we look at what the alt-right originally stood for when we all started doing this stuff the better part of a decade ago, it was to overcome, you know, what we now call cuckservatism, you know, to create a more genuine right in America. And it was also to overcome the legacy of things like the Klan and National Socialism. And basically, Unite the Right has put us back into that mode where everyone associates us with those things. And that's a problem.
You know, the alt-right did have a positive net effect on the Trump campaign. And someday, decades from now, the full story of that will be told.
Oh, for sure. I wouldn't deny that.
But based on my knowledge of this, and there are other people who can, if they want to come forward and contradict me, they can. But based on my knowledge of this, that positive effect was based on our networking, our ability to build a network of trust and to actually motivate people to work in harmony with one another to that end. And there were projects in the last days and weeks of the election that alt-right people collaborated together on, that alt-right people thought of and collaborated together on, and it was effective. The networking was where we had our strength. And the problem, though, with the alt-right troll culture is what I call the troll's veto. And we saw this with the ridiculous and, I think, harmful Daily Stormer March on Whitefish campaign, which was never sincere. They never were actually planning to do this. This was just an attempt to get people talking about the Daily Stormer and get people upset. It was just an attempt at triggering people. And the trouble is, though, is it caused a huge amount of sympathy for leftists and Jews in that area that just didn't exist before, and made life on the ground much more difficult for the actual white nationalists who had moved there and created a community and a network. And our real strength ultimately lies in our real world communities and networks, and that means we have to be able to trust each other and work together and so forth. And this kind of troll culture can destroy that. When Hailgate happened, that was Richard Spencer basically pandering to the troll wing, the troll culture of the movement. And by doing it in front of the cameras of the world press, basically, he had a catastrophic effect on the networks that had been built up over the past year, because people thought, oh my God, these people aren't ready for prime time. This is buffoonery. We can't be associated with this, and so forth. And so a lot of those connections that had been built up over time fell apart. And those are the kinds of connections that were giving us the ability to actually produce real world effects. And so the problem that I would like to see dealt with is finding a way of disciplining this troll culture, but there's really no way of doing that as far as I know, because it's so decentralized. Basically, the only way that anybody could whip this thing into some semblance of discipline is for people who have a great deal of credibility in that troll culture to exercise some of their credibility and some of their capital to try and get these people to be more responsible. But I honestly don't know how effective that can be, but they should at least try it. Because the idea that, well, lol, dude, it's just a meme and we can say anything and we don't have to worry about consequences is just blatantly irresponsible. And since the election, since Hailgate, there's been a parade of increasingly polarizing and really kind of disgusting memes that have been bruited about in our circles that really have, I think, undermined our network, undermined our trust, made it impossible for certain people to work together, and made our movement weaker rather than stronger.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I mean, it went from, during the election, you could still debate if it was a good idea even then, but the oven memes and stuff like that, it was all clearly ironic to anyone except for the mainstream media. But since the election, I think that, they've kind of crossed from being ironic to actually, at least some people, I'm not talking about everybody, but some people seem to have actually kind of embraced some of the things that used to be ironic.
Yeah, a lot of people put it this way. The human mind runs on principles, and you can be putting out memes and saying, oh, I'm just being ironic, but the fact is there are a lot of impressionable people who are trying to stock their minds with principles, and these memes end up being principles of action, even if they're not meant to, because if there's a vacuum, they will fill it, and therefore, you have to think about the potential consequences of spreading these memes. And it is not sufficient to just say I'm being ironic, therefore I am not responsible. I can't be held responsible for what people do. And that is another premise that is as catastrophic as the premise that all publicity is good publicity. It totally gets you off the hook about thinking ahead, thinking about consequences, taking responsibility for consequences. And again, this would be all well and good if it were a hopeless cause and just a subculture of people who are just mentally masturbating, and it's never going to amount to anything. However, I think we can actually change the world. We can actually win. And if we can actually win, we have to start thinking in terms of what's necessary to win. And that means that we have to have a certain level of seriousness, a certain level of planning ahead and so forth. That's just not present in the ethos of the movement today.
The ability to communicate with normal people and not just 4chan.
Right. One of the things that I loved about Hartiste's commentary on Hailgate, I thought it was very, very insightful. Hartiste put something up there under the heading Attention Horror of the Month about Hailgate, and he said that the mistake of Hailgate was thinking that stuff that works in the echo chamber of our own online movement plays well in front of the cameras of the world press. And I thought, yeah, that's exactly right. There was no thought given to that. And in fairness, the guys who in the audience who were doing the salutes didn't know that the cameras of the world press were turned on at that time. They thought this was a private setting. Spencer knew that the cameras were there, but the people in the audience didn't. And I think that, if they had been aware of that, they probably wouldn't have done it, and therefore the event wouldn't have happened. Even though Spencer obviously was sort of leading the way with the hail thing and raising his glass and so forth, they probably wouldn't have done it if they had known there were cameras present.
It was later in the evening, too, when people had been imbibing and whatnot.
Oh, for quite some time. Yeah, definitely. But exactly, but still we do need a little bit of discipline in that area too, right? I mean, the someday somebody's going to have to write an entire book of all the catastrophes that have happened because of people making decisions while they're drunk. That would be an actually a really interesting book for a kind of popularizing historian, right? Basically, you know, every instance of some catastrophe that was basically could be connected to somebody who was being a statesman while drunk, being a king while drunk, being a general while drunk, being whatever while drunk, under the influence. That would be a great title, Under the Influence. You know, 50 historical catastrophes that were caused by drugs and alcohol. You know, somebody needs to write that book. It'd be a bestseller. But anyway, yeah, that's another area where we obviously need a little bit of discipline.
Well, I would say also part of this echo chamber effect that I have noticed is some people seem to think that, what was it, 60 million, or I forget exactly how many Americans voted for Trump, but that all of those people did it because they were sympathetic to the alt-right. And while I don't doubt that there's a significant minority of that 60 million that is, or at least was, you know, I've talked to, Michigan was one of the states that almost always votes Democrat in recent history that defected to Trump this time around. And I've talked to, you know, ordinary Michiganders who voted for Trump, and, you know, a lot of them have never heard of the alt-right, and they find the ideas, you know, when I tried to explain it to them, still a little bit strange. So, you know, we still have a lot of work to do, and I think some people allowed themselves to think that we were further along than we really are.
Yeah, I would agree. Just to segue back to Cantwell before we finish this discussion, it's important to emphasize that Cantwell was maced a couple of times on camera. We see this in the Vice documentary, and there's other video out there of him being attacked by pepper spray. And he attacks somebody back by pepper spray, and now he's in jail. He went into jail, he was given bail, but then the bail was challenged, and he is in jail without bail, awaiting charges for doing something, namely pepper spraying somebody, probably clearly in self-defense, that was done hundreds, maybe thousands of times on that day in Charlottesville. And the question that I have is, how many other people are in jail awaiting felony charges for pepper spray use? I don't know of any others. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'd love to be wrong about this. And how many of these people can't get bail?
Well, there's another aspect of this, Greg, which is the type of pepper spray that a lot of the Antifa was using was this bear pepper spray. In some states, but not all, it's actually illegal to use it on humans. Apparently, that's not the case in Virginia. But it just goes to show, I mean, these people, it wasn't just ordinary pepper spray, and that's why some people suffered real damage to their eyesight as a result of having it used on them. So they knew, but they, I mean, this wasn't just, you know, about self-defense or whatever. I mean, they knew that they were setting out to try to injure these people seriously.
Nothing says you care like coming with bear spray or improvised flamethrowers. Nothing says you care.
No.
Better than that. Well, yeah, so Cantwell is being obviously singled out for unjust prosecution here.
Because he participated in the Vice interview.
Probably, yeah, that probably has a lot to do with it. Yeah, definitely, because he made himself a very, very public spectacle, and a kind of scary public spectacle. So maybe that's what's going on.
Because I noticed when the rally first occurred, they were kind of trying to associate it with Spencer being the leader. And then after the Vice thing, all of a sudden it switched to Cantwell. If you look at how the media's narrative kind of evolved, because I think they found out that he was a better test case, you know, to try to smear us with.
Better Hollywood Nazi.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it is interesting how that shifted. And exactly, they were looking for somebody who would give them what they could run with to push their narrative. And Cantwell foolishly did that. To his discredit, it is wrong, though, what they're doing to him. And I feel sorry for the guy. And if you feel sorry for him, you know, reach out and give him some support. He's stuck in the Charlottesville jail. I think he's still in the Charlottesville jail if he hasn't been moved. And he's facing all kinds of charges. My feeling about it is that this is an obvious miscarriage of justice. However, it is a miscarriage of justice in the criminal justice system sense, clearly. But also, he sort of set himself up for this by cavorting with his guns in front of the vice cameras and giving the enemy what they wanted. He got his 15 minutes of fame, and it blew up in his face, unfortunately. So I'm going to keep following this, but it is an example of how blatantly biased the system is. And eventually, though, I think the narrative with Cantwell is going to unwind as well. I think there has been a great moral panic, and I think the far left have been using that as an opportunity to crack down on all of us. One thing that was brought up by Millennial Woes in a recent video that really indicates the skewed priorities here is during the aftermath of Charlottesville, there were no fewer than 5 Islamist attacks. And yet there was no massive deplatforming of Islamists throughout the internet. There was no concern with that at all.
Yeah, one was the mass car ramming in Barcelona.
Yeah, which was clearly an act of terrorism.
Yeah, how many people did that take out?
13, I believe.
Yeah.
And some journalists actually had the gall to claim that the terrorists may have been inspired by the guy in Charlottesville, which, I mean, anybody who's been conscious the last couple of years would know that that's bullshit.
Wasn't it Wolf Blitzer who called it a copycat attack?
He was one of them, but there were others as well.
Yeah, it's just disgusting. And I'm sure these people sit around in their bars at night chuckling over how they put another one over on the gullible goyim. They truly are disgusting liars. And I would love to see a system where journalists have to be licensed. And every year their license yeah. comes up for review. And if people can show that they have told lies and distortions, that they can be banned from journalism for life. I mean, they're a very powerful group of people. They call them the Fifth Estate, right? That's one of the power blocks that constitute our ruling class. And yet these people are totally unlicensed. They have total license to lie, basically. And sometimes their lies actually cause people to die, like the lies that they told about Michael Brown and Trayvon Martin. People have died because of the lies that they have run with. These Black Lives Matter type lies that they brooded about. People have been murdered because of this. Policemen were murdered in New York City because of this. And they bear absolutely no responsibility under the current system. That really should change. They really, when journalists lie and people die, journalists need to feel blowback from that. They need to be banned from journalism. They need to just have their keyboards taken away from them.
Well, thankfully, their influence is waning, and I think the technology is going to be their undoing. You know, the more, you know, Internet 2.0, Web 3.0 comes out, this blockchain-based distributed Internet that cannot be censored, there's nothing to keep anybody from being an independent journalist. I mean, already things are moving in that direction. You know, you'll see more people like Tim Pool. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he has this YouTube channel and goes out and basically just does his own journalism.
Right.
So, you know, I think the truth will out that way, and it's not going to be this echo chamber like it is currently.
Right.
But also, there'll be healthy competition among journalists when that happens, and if something is untrue, you won't have this clique, this oligarchy, suppressing the truth or selectively ignoring evidence but covering other bits of evidence. You know, you'll be able to get the full picture.
Right, exactly. Well, I would like to segue now just to the final segment. We've been going at this for quite a while, actually. This is going to be one of our longer episodes. I want to do a little shop talk segment now, and I want to announce a new project from Countercurrents that I'm very, very excited about. The 18th of this month is the 100th birthday of Francis Parker Yockey. And on the 18th, I'm going to be doing a small dinner in honor of his 100th birthday. And that will be the day we officially unveil this all online. But what we're going to do is launch a new edition, a centennial edition of the complete writings of Francis Parker Yockey. And it is going to be in 3 volumes. The first volume will be Imperium. The second volume will be The Enemy of Europe, and the third volume is called The World in Flames, which contains all of his other surviving writings. That volume is edited by Kerry Bolton, K.R. Bolton, and John is working with him on finishing up the editing of this. I've been working with Kevin Slaughter on a cover, actually on covers for all 3 volumes. And the cover, I think, looks pretty magnificent, so I'm really excited about how this edition is going to look. like the Savitri Devi Archive Centennial Edition of Savitri's Complete Writings, which is a much longer edition because she published a lot more than Yaki did, we are going to do the hardcovers in a limited edition of 200 numbered copies. They're going to be extremely high quality hardcovers, the best quality available, basically. And we will take subscriptions, basically, in advance. We'll let people pre-order and we'll assign numbers to them. And then there'll be a standard paperback edition as well. The order of publication is going to be Volume 3 first. That's the one that Carrie Bolton is working on. And that's the one that contains the most rare stuff that's otherwise unavailable. There are editions of Imperium and The Enemy of Europe out there already. So if you want to read those, it's easy for you to get them. The edition of Imperium that we're going to do will appear within the next couple of years. I'm going to edit it. I am going to have scholarly notes and things like that. It's going to be the first attempt at a kind of critical edition of it. And one of the things that I'm going to do is based on work by a writer named Sebastian Linderhoff that I commissioned to, he's a Schmidt scholar, and I commissioned him to write about Yaki's plagiarism of Carl Schmidt. We're going to identify very clearly all the things in Imperium that come from Schmidt. There are other sources that need to be checked into. It's a kind of a pastiche, really. Yaki folded in a lot of stuff from Schmidt and perhaps other writers as well. And I'd like to clearly identify where all of that is in the book and write an introduction that basically sort of lays out, as best I can determine, how this book was written and what its main sources are. So that'll be coming out in the next couple of years. And the Enemy of Europe book has an interesting history. It was written in English, then translated by Yaki into German. And the original English was lost, and the German edition was seized and pretty much destroyed, but there are a few copies in various libraries. And what happened was one of these German copies was given to Revolo Oliver, who translated it into English again. So it's a reverse translation from German back into the original language. And that is available. I have a copy of the German, and what I'm planning to do is put out a bilingual edition, because the German version is Yaki's work, and it's very clearly the work of a person who is not a native speaker of German, because he uses certain words that a native German speaker wouldn't use in his translation. And so I would like to have that in there, and then I'm going to commission, I haven't decided which, a new, fresh German translation, or an English translation from the German, and we'll put that out as well. So this year we'll put out Volume 3, The World in Flames, and then in coming years we'll put out new editions of Imperium and The Enemy of Europe, and that will be the complete surviving writings of Francis Parker Yaki. Now, there are things that he published that we just don't have copies of. He published articles in this newsletter called Front Fighter, and unfortunately we don't have copies of that newsletter, a complete run of that newsletter.
Some of them. We do have some of them.
Yeah, we don't have some of them. Eventually, though, I hope that these things will come to light and we'll just publish augmented editions. There may be more Yaki correspondence that comes to light, more Yaki essays that come to light, and we'll just publish a second edition of The World in Flames, or a third or a fourth, however many editions it is required to make it truly a collected works. So I'm very, very excited about this project. Charles Kraft is also doing a Francis Parker Yaki commemorative plate, which we will unveil on the 18th as well. So Yaki fans rejoice. His 100th birthday is not only going to be marked, but honored, and it's going to be honored in the best way I know how, which is to create the first complete and really scholarly edition of his works.
Has it ever been proven whether or not he wrote Oswald Mosley's book, The Alternative? Because that's been speculated for a long time.
I don't know about that. That's something I'd like to ask Carrie Bolton about.
As far as I know, we don't. But if he did, then you could do an edition of that as well.
Yeah, there are some pieces by Frederick Weiss that seem to have been ghostwritten by Yockey. And we do know that Yockey wrote a speech for Senator McCarthy, which will be included in this volume. And we will also include the pieces by Weiss that we think were ghostwritten by Yockey as an appendix. So any other things that he ghostwrote over the years, we will include. Now, I do know for a fact that Yockey offered Imperium to Mosley and said, here, put your name on this if you want, and Mosley refused. But that doesn't mean that Mosley wouldn't have perhaps used him as a ghostwriter. But honestly, Mosley was a really good writer, unless all of his stuff was ghostwritten. But I think that's probably not true.
Well, I'm thinking it's in Coogan's book on Yockey. He raises this possibility because it was published at the time that Mosley and Yockey were in contact, and if you read the book, it is striking how similar it is to Yockey's own ideas, which of course could be just because Mosley was in contact with him at the time.
Right.
But some people have suggested that he actually ghost wrote it.
That's really interesting. Yeah, let's ask Carrie Bolton about that. And as the Yockey Centennial approaches, let's do an interview with Carrie about this. I think that'll be great. Another thing that is going to happen sometime in the next year or two is the appearance of Bolton's new definitive biography of Yockey. I do hope that that comes out eventually.
Yes, it's huge. It'll be as long as Coogan's, I think, or almost.
Good, but it won't be full of padding like Coogan's.
Well, there's a lot of good information in there, but it's true. I mean, it's about a lot of other... I mean, a lot of it's very interesting, like his stuff about James Madole.
Right.
Which I've never... It's basically the only source on Madole. I've never been able to find much about... Well, except for some things that Carrie did, actually, like that little Phoenix Rising book.
Right.
I don't know. Coogan's book is interesting, although his biases are clear.
Oh, yeah, his biases are clear. And he doesn't just mention Evola. He has to give a whole biography of Evola and talk about Evola. And I just feel...
Oh, and refer to him as mentally ill.
Yeah.
He actually refers to... Just in, you know, doesn't give any citation, just refers to him as having been mentally ill.
Right. Right. Well, guys, I think this is a pretty good point to end at. Are there any other things you'd like to say just to wrap this one up?
Well, Greg, you're going to be re-releasing Defiance, right?
Well, I got tons of Defiance, actually. I've got cases of that in paperback, but Gold in the Furnace in paperback is almost out of print, and so I am going to be re-releasing that as a print-on-demand title sometime in the fall. So that's something to look forward to. And the next volume in the Savitri Devi edition, her centennial edition, will be Pilgrimage. But honestly, I was hoping I'd get that out this year, but it looks like I'll be getting that out in the new year. I've just got too many other projects to juggle. But that will be the next volume in the centennial edition, Pilgrimage.
I hope you do her autobiography in English at some point.
Yeah, that'll be something in the coming years as well. I really want to get this White Nationalist Manifesto done.
Yeah,
Once that's off my plate, it's been weighing on me all year. Once that's off my plate, I'm going to get a lot more editing done with the Savitri edition, and I'm going to be digging into doing this new Yockey edition as well, and just clearing a backlog of other books and book projects that I'd like to bring out. Well, John, Mike, thanks so much. This has been a really good conversation. And join us next time, a week from today, for our next Countercurrents Radio.